This week on your weekly constitutional, stories of immigration, some of them adventurous, some of them downright terrifying.
Following the outbreak of the coup, my family hid out in a cave for about 4 months until they were able to secure a raft. After being at sea for a little while, they were picked up off the coast of Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, by a U.S. Coast Guard cutter.
On today's show, we'll speak to three of my students, three immigrants who came here as young children with their families. Their stories are remarkable and poignant. And they told them first at a symposium organized by my good friend and colleague, Akram Pfizer. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And this week, it's who are these immigrants anyway?
You're listening to your weekly constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee. YWC is underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier.
Immigration is a very constitutional topic. Article 1 of the Constitution gives Congress plenary, that is, total authority over immigration, and Congress has legislated in this area many times. It's also delegated much of its power to the president so that he can execute the laws involving immigration. Indeed, an entire bureaucracy has grown up around immigration, and immigration reform is something that people have been discussing, not doing much about, but discussing for a long time. Perhaps you've heard that the controversial DACA program, the Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals program, which was championed by the Obama administration, is slated to be discontinued by the Trump administration. With all of this constitutionality and all of this political discussion, it occurs to me that sometimes we forget that immigration is not just a legal issue, it's not just a political issue, it's a human issue. I was reminded of that fact when my colleague, Akram Pfizer of Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law, recently organized a symposium highlighting the stories of some of our own immigrant students. When he did that, I knew that I had to have some of those students on this program, and I knew that I would have to start with Akram. So Akram, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Stuart.
It's your second time, isn't it?
Yes. It's a delight to be here.
It's a delight to have you. Now, today we're going to talk about a program that you organized last spring all about immigration and immigrants. Tell me why you did that.
We had received a large number of transfer students from the Charlotte School of Law as of January of last year, right, many of whom were students from diverse backgrounds. And Justice Wade called me into his office and thought, you know, this would be a great thing to explore, to manifest how, you know, how the law school has auspiciously seen a substantial uptick in diversity amongst in its student body with the arrival of those transfer students. And he thought maybe the entire student body could learn and benefit from being exposed to sort of the life narratives of these students.
Excuse me for interrupting, but just a little bit of background there. There's been an unfortunate circumstance at Charlotte, and it looks like they're in the process of shutting down that law school. That's bad, and it's bad for everybody involved, and we certainly feel bad about it. But one of the things we were able to do back in January on very short notice was to absorb well over a dozen students.
Exactly.
Who came to us from Charlotte, and I had the the challenge and the pleasure of teaching virtually all of them in a civil procedure class, which was a rollicking adventure for all of us because we had students from different levels and had different backgrounds. But I can personally attest to exactly what you and Judge Wade were talking about, and that is that the instant these students came in, there was a great uptick in diversity. We're located in East Tennessee, which is a population of which is fairly homogenous. It's fairly white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. And in this region of the country, getting a lot of diverse people from diverse backgrounds in the law school is always a challenge. Mm-hmm. And so this was a very noticeable change in our student body. And so please continue. You and Judge Wade, you're the chair of the diversity committee, aren't you?
I was then the chair.
Right.
And he said, why don't you see if you can organize something? Send an email, reach out to students to see if they'd be willing to talk about, you know, if they have an international background that they're willing to share. I did so, and several students responded very forthrightly. One was Leila Hadzic, who, you know, in a strange way, the ethnic pentathon, as the U.S. Census Department uses, does not really accurately describe the diversity in American life that we have today. And Ms. Hadzic was an excellent example. She's described as white American, but she actually is a Bosnian Muslim refugee from the war that broke out in the 90s in the former Yugoslavia. Her family was from Banja Luka in what is now Bosnia and Herzegovina, and was forced to flee to a refugee camp from which they came to the United States.
And there was no specific category for such people.
No, in fact, you know, if you look at the admissions forms that the Law School Admissions Council uses, she's merely self-identified as white American. Mm-hmm. But she was not born in this country. She grew up, spent many years in a refugee camp. Her parents were victims of war and migrated to this country not knowing much English at all. Mm-hmm. And she's done very well for herself, her and her sister. Her sister's a physician.
Wow.
And she now is a law student, a very delightful young woman. Mm-hmm. And basically is seeking a law degree and is doing very well in that regard.
And, mm-hmm. and a very compelling story. Her father came and spoke as well, if I recall
correctly. Exactly. Her
yeah.
father, Sanko Hazic, came with her mother, and they both were at the invitation of Justice Wade. Mm-hmm. They both came and spoke quite compellingly about how he was requisitioned to serve in the military mm-hmm. during the Civil War, how he came to the United States after Banja Luka was overrun by the Bosnian Serbs. Mm-hmm. Banja Luka being the second largest city in Bosnia, which has a plurality Muslim population, but was then overrun by the Serb separatists.
Mm-hmm. And some pretty bad things were going on there.
Exactly.
As we all recall from that era. Well, who were the other students?
There was Ruth Aramburu, who was born in Peru. And her parents immigrated from Peru and brought them with her, and she therefore grew up. She's born in Peru and grew up as an immigrant from Peru. And it was interesting to acculturate our students to the narrative of a legal immigrant, Hispanic immigrant, who was non-Mexican or non-Central American. Mm-hmm. I thought that was very useful, and the discrimination she felt and she described, and the difficulty she felt as a legal immigrant. I think there's a tendency amongst many of our white students to make a supposition that there are all kinds of handouts and programs and disbursements given out to immigrants, which is unfair to the majority population. And she quite accurately pointed out sort of the difficulty she went through, what her parents went through, and how they were able. She described, for example, how her father held many jobs at the same time to support his family. Mm-hmm. It was quite moving, and it was I think it was quite timely, especially in view of where our politics were at that time. And remain to this day. Mm-hmm.
And then we also have a young man named Jeff Prepti from
yes.
Haiti. Tell me about him, please.
His family, his father was a democracy activist in Haiti and was working with the government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the democratically elected government that was then overthrown in a military coup in Haiti that forced Aristide at the time to flee and forced his family into hiding. They chose to try and seek asylum in the United States. The problem was Haitian asylees were being shunted to Guantanamo Bay at the time mm-hmm. and denied entry into the United States. And by luck, the family left on a boat and were taken and brought back to South Florida. Mm-hmm. I think they might have spent some time in Guantanamo Bay, and then mm-hmm. they were allowed to enter Florida. And the choice was for Mr. Prepted, for his family, was do they live in South Florida, where there was an abundant Haitian population, but a socioeconomically distressed one? Mm-hmm. Or did his father take an opportunity to move to East Tennessee, which he did? And Mr. Prepted talked about how his father basically had to work to just support his family and help him get through. And Mr. Prepted then went to college in East Tennessee and law school
right.
thereafter.
And he's a delightful young man, too. And he's very loquacious. He likes to talk in class. And so,
I've never had him in class, uh-huh, but he is unfailingly polite.
Oh, extremely polite. Just, yeah. He's delightful to have in class.
Yeah.
All three of these students are delightful. And and that was a delightful program. And as you point out, a very moving program. Mm. And so I really appreciate your having set it up. It was really marvelous. Was the reaction of the student population here at the law school to your program? Did it prompt sort of conversations that you wanted it to?
Two things. First of all, the attendance was wonderful.
It was full.
It was a full room.
There were standing room.
And I don't think there are too many law schools in this country where you'll have almost 100% attendance for an event involving students.
No.
And so that's to the credit of the students and the mm-hmm. administration that helped organize this. But yes, I received excellent feedback. It's wonderful feedback. And I think it was especially important because one of the things having a startup school is we don't have the typical things that another law school might have or university would have for student socialization. We don't have dorms. Mm-hmm. We don't have a cafeteria. And we don't have a gym. But notwithstanding those challenges, our students, I think, have found a really, really great way to sort of bond and understand each other's narratives and to appreciate each other.
And one thing we do have, and you're right, I mean, we're an urban campus and we're in a historic building and there's not a lot of space to build those sort of facilities. But one thing we do have is this marvelous atrium up here on the third floor where you and I both have offices and then faculty offices on both sides and alcoves. But then the students, that's really the beating heart of the law school is that atrium. And at any given moment on a school day, and even on the weekends when I've been here, the students are all out there mixing and coming together. I think there's a real sense of community here.
I think you're absolutely right. And mm-hmm. so it's a wonderful thing. And I think the event, if it did anything, it did many things, I think. But at the very least, it furthered that sense of community. And I think it opened up people's narratives. Opened up people to the narrative of the immigrant or the refugee or the asylee, which I think has been demotically characterized based on the parlous state of our domestic politics.
Understood. Well, Akram Pfizer, professor at the Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Stuart.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week our topic is, who are these immigrants anyway, these people who are so much in the news? We heard just now from Akram Pfizer, my colleague at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law, who organized a symposium on this subject. And after the break, we'll hear from several of my immigrant students. Stick around. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week our question is, who are these immigrants anyway? These people who are so much in the news, these people who are causing all these problems and all this political and constitutional debate. Sometimes we forget that they're human beings. But some of them are at my law school. Some of them are my students. And now we're going to talk to several of them, starting with a woman named Layla.
My name is Layla Hadzik. I am a student at Duncan School of Law. I'm a third-year student, so I'll be graduating in May 2018.
I still find that remarkable that you're a third-year already. But go on, please.
I know. Exciting. Uh-huh. And I actually transferred here. I went to Charlotte School of Law, and with everything that happened,
I'm sorry about that, but we're happy to have you.
Yes, thank you.
Absolutely. In fact, you were one of my Charlotte refugees in the spring, weren't you?
Yes, we were.
And we had each other
second
for
second time being a refugee.
Well, no. Yes, in some sense, that's true. That actually reminds me what brings us here today, because last spring, in the spring of 2017, Professor Pfizer organized a very interesting event focused upon our own immigrants here at the Duncan School of Law. And I was surprised by how many we have, first and second generation. And I was really moved by some of the stories. And I recall your story as well. In fact, I believe your father was here too, wasn't he?
Yes, both my parents were here.
Yes. Well, please tell us about that.
Yeah. So we, in, you may or may not know, but in like around 1990, the war started, a civil war in Bosnia. Mm-hmm. And then my dad was a soldier during that time. Pretty much we went from, city to city, try to escape wherever you can. My sister, I have a sister, she was already born. She was born in 91. I was born in 95. And so during that time, my entire family was born in one city. And then, of course, I was born in a completely different city.
So where did your family start?
We started in Banja Luka.
Banja Luka. Mm-hmm. And where is that in Bosnia?
Is
it a big city?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty popular at the time, still is. And then when obviously the war was happening, we didn't have food, we didn't have anything.
And you were born in the midst of all of this.
Mm-hmm, in 95. And the war, some people say it ended in, end of 95, but most people say beginning of 96, So mm-hmm. it's, I usually say just 96.
And where were you born then?
I was born in Travnik. Okay. So that's little away from, not too far from Banja Luka, but I always make fun of myself because I say my entire family was born in Banja Luka, and then I was the only one.
You're the outlier.
Yes.
All right.
But we the reason I was born there was because we didn't, my parents didn't have any food to feed my sister, or I guess myself with my mom. So we had.
Now, was your dad fighting in the war all this time?
Yes.
So he was away fighting, and so mom was was taking care of you.
And you know, my dad doesn't typically talk about war stories, or doesn't like to, I guess, tell too much about you know what he's done. But you know, he has told me things such as he'd like, you know, be fighting in the war, and then he'd know he has a family behind, so he'd come back if he found, you know, food, anything like that. Or him and my mom would like meet up at certain places, and you know, he would give any food that he had or stuff like that. It's pretty rough. And my mom, I mean, my mom would walk like miles and miles to get us food, you know, same with my dad while he was a soldier. And so my mom, pretty much they just made the decision to go somewhere else because they were like, we just don't have food here. So that's when we went to Travnik, and then I was born at that time. Mm-hmm. But I know my dad tells me stories about, it's so crazy, when you hear the bomb coming and you hear it, you're in the clear. But if you like hear it go off, but you don't hear the ending of it, it's, you better run.
Oh my.
So I remember he used to tell me that story all the time, and I'm like, that's just crazy to hear, because it's like at any point you could know that your life's about to end, and it's, you know, and you like hear it, and you can, but there's nothing you can do about it except just wait for it, you know. And then we came to the United States in 96 when it ended. Since my aunt and uncle lived in Pennsylvania, Erie, Pennsylvania, we told them, you know, Erie, Pennsylvania. That way we knew somebody at least.
Sure.
And we only came with, I was one, of course, so I don't remember, but I just remember my parents telling me all we had was a little, you know, Walmart grocery bag, whatever, full of nothing, pretty much.
Do you mind telling me what your family's background is?
Yeah, we're actually Muslim.
Okay.
And so, yeah, you're right. It was, you know, between Croatians and Serbs.
Right.
And then, you know, the Muslims and the Serbs were, you know, the dominant side, of course. But
did you find any difficulty coming here as a Muslim family? Or, I mean, I realize you were a baby at the time. So did your parents relate to you, any difficulties they may have had?
Not until, you know, after 2001. I think that's when things changed for, I think, all Muslims, you know.
It sounds to me like you had a fairly successful, very hardworking and very difficult first few years. But on the other hand, there was work. There was food.
Yeah.
It was better than it had been in Bosnia, I'm taking it.
Sure.
The thing seemed to be on the upward swing, but then you mentioned before that after 2001, things changed. Do you remember that time?
Yeah, so that's obviously when 9/11 occurred. And I think people took a different outlook on Muslims at that point. I don't think anybody thought of Muslims as, you know, radicals or bad human beings in that sense, you know. And I think after that, that's when things started to change. You know, once you tell people, oh, I'm Muslim, their whole persona changed, you know. And there's been many times where my parents are like, you know, would say, oh, I'm from here, or, and you'd get the response, oh, go back to where you're from, you know, go back to your country. You shouldn't be here. Your people are what caused, you know, 9/11 or things like that. And granted, they didn't get too much of it like they could have if, and me and my family don't wear hijabs, so we don't look like your typical, you know, Muslims that people think of. So obviously, until you tell somebody that you're Muslim, they don't, I guess, that, you know, you don't know. But as soon as you tell that, and I've actually had an experience with that where I was at an amusement park and it was an odd number of me and my friends. And so I had to sit alone on one of the rides, but they fill up all the seats. And there was another odd group of friends. And so I had this kid sit next to me, and eventually he heard like my friends saying my name, and he was like, wait, what's your name? And I was like, oh, it's Layla. And he's like, Layla? Layla? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, where are you from? And I was like, and I was just confused because I didn't know what, you know, he was. He's like, where are you from? And I was like, oh, I'm from Bosnia. And he's like, what are you? And I was like, what do you mean, what am I? You know, you don't get typical questions of what are you? And he's like, what are you? I said. And I'm like, what do you mean? And he's like, just what are you, Muslim? Sir? You know, and I'm like, oh, I'm Muslim. And he's like, get away from me.
You want to ride together. It's kind of hard to get away.
This was like when we were getting off. So good thing It was like the docking happened in the beginning and then after the ride. And he was like, get away from me. And I like freaked out because I didn't know what was going on. And he ended up being a Serb. And he's like, my parents always told me not to talk to you guys.
Oh my.
And that's crazy because, you know, my parents are friends with Serbs. You know, like we, no matter what, my parents always told me, treat people how you want to be treated, no matter what. Doesn't matter what happened. You need to treat every individual like you want to be treated. And so it was actually really surprising to see that people teach their kids to act that way, you know? Yeah. And so
there's a line from an old Rodgers and Hammerstein movie, they have to be carefully taught to hate that way.
Yeah.
And sadly, some people are. So you experienced some of that.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, it wasn't constant.
Yeah.
I mean, it was occasional, if I understand you correctly.
Yeah.
And then you were in school.
Mm-hmm.
And you went to college. Where'd you go to college?
I went to Gannon University, mm-hmm. which is in Erie, Pennsylvania.
Right.
I majored in legal studies
because
I knew from little that I wanted to be a lawyer.
You wanted to be a lawyer. And you were just telling me how much you're enjoying your trial procedure class.
Yes.
So I'm very pleased to hear that, taught by our dean, who's a former judge. So now you're here at law school.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to be the first lawyer in your family?
I am. Mm-hmm. I am, yep. And my sister's in med school right now. So.
Good heavens. A doctor and a lawyer.
Yes.
Now, did either of your parents have the benefit of college education when they were back in Bosnia?
No, they only had a high school education.
Right.
But one thing they always, you know, kind of tell me is, you know, even though we had a high school education, it's like a college degree because it is so hard. The schooling there is very difficult.
Right.
And it just much more convoluted and just, I don't know, they just have so many more subjects and they're, mm-hmm. You have to take, it's like required from when you're little to take language classes. So, mm-hmm. I know my dad took like French or German. I think he took German or French. I can't mm-hmm. remember exactly. But he always says, yeah, school is so much harder down there. So really, I did get into college.
Okay, good for dad, good for mom. Well, Layla, thanks very much for your time today. Appreciate
it. You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that was quite a journey from the battlefields of Bosnia to Erie, Pennsylvania, and now Knoxville, Tennessee. My next student is Jeff Preptee. He's from Haiti, or I should say his family is from Haiti, where they had to flee after a military coup.
My name is Jeff Preptee from Bristol, Tennessee, born and raised, but I am the youngest of five children and the only one of my family born here in the United States.
So you're not an immigrant yourself, but you are the child of immigrants.
Yes.
And the sibling of immigrants.
Yes, exactly. Okay. So we jokingly call me like a 1.5 generation immigrant. So not necessarily first generation, but not second generation quite yet. But yeah, my brother actually calls our sibling group four and a half foreigners.
Four and a half foreigners. Where's your family from?
So my family is from a small island within the island nation. We are from Kaimit, Haiti, which is in the province of Guacaimit, which is just large Kaimit. So it is about a 12-hour boat ride from the capital, and it's sort of like a village area. But my family immigrated to the United States in 92 following the military coup that deposed the president, the first democratically elected president of Haiti, Jean-Bertrand Aristide.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, dad was an official within the government, within the judiciary, sort of an intermediate, like, clerical position within the judiciary. And that was a political appointee position, so he was a party official. And so during the process of the coup, he and my family had become targets of political assassination.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, so following the outbreak of the coup, my family had hid out in a cave for about 4 months until they were able to secure a raft to be able to exit the country. Luckily, my dad, since he was about the age of 9, had been fishing on the ocean, so he knew how to use the currents to sail and use the stars and everything. So after being at sea for a little while, they were picked up off the coast of Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, by a U.S. Coast Guard cutter. And while they were there, they were able to apply for political asylum and were able to make their way into the United States.
That sounds like a movie.
Yeah, it could be.
I mean, not to belittle what's going on here or disrespect it, but it sounds like an adventure story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what a difficult escape.
Exactly, yeah. It's definitely, it's been I wouldn't necessarily say challenging, but it's definitely been a pedigree has taken some effort to live up to, because my parents have definitely given up a lot for me and my siblings to be in the position that we are today. All of us being college educated.
You're getting ahead of the story now, Jeff. Oh, wow. Getting ahead of the story here. Let's take it chronologically.
Okay.
So, again, what year was this?
Was 92.
92. Mm-hmm. So they make their way over the ocean to Guantanamo. Mm-hmm. Is anybody injured on the way? I mean, I hope everybody made it.
Yeah, everybody made it.
On a raft?
Yes, on a raft.
On a raft. Yeah. Like that means like logs lashed together.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say it was like a log raft, mm-hmm. but it wasn't necessarily... You couldn't really call it a boat either. Mm-hmm. It was just a
collection. It was a handmade boat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That your father and perhaps your brothers or other
other family members.
Put together. How many people mm-hmm. were on this boat?
So it was mom and dad, my 4 siblings. My sister, who's closest in age to me, was about 1.5 at the time.
Young children.
Yeah, very young children. Oh, so my oldest brother was 8 years old when they came to the United States, so he was about 7.5 when all of this was
occurring.
So he
wasn't really able to help out, so this was mm-hmm. your brother and your uncles.
Mm-hmm, yeah, so close family members, close family friends mm-hmm. who helped organize all this and get this all together.
And so then how many people were on the boat roughly? Give me a ballpark.
I would say, including my family, probably 2 others as well.
So this is like 6 or 7 people then?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Okay, and how big was this boat? Did they tell you?
No, I wouldn't be able to give you specs or anything. Yeah.
But it sounds like it's quite a bit of family lore there. I imagine you've heard the story a few times.
Yeah, a couple of times, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So they make their way.
Mm-hmm.
So, forgive me, one more question about the boat. Did it have a sail?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so they were sailing on mm-hmm. these ocean currents.
Yeah.
Okay, so they had some means of locomotion other than paddling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They make their way to Guantanamo. They're picked up by the cutter. They apply mm-hmm. for asylum. How long did that take?
About 2 months.
2 months.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they spent 2 months in Guantanamo Bay, which was before it was a naval detention center. So at the time, just a naval base. But
Now, generally speaking, I'm no expert on immigration law, mm-hmm. but my understanding is to get political asylum, you have to be able to prove mm-hmm. that you would suffer persecution if you were there. And so I guess your family qualified. Mm-hmm. For
definitely qualified. Okay. And luckily, Dad had the forethought to ensure that he had proper paperwork and everything.
He had to bring the paperwork with him on the boat mm-hmm. and keep it dry.
Yeah, so he even still to this day has this old leather satchel that's like basically just falling apart that mm-hmm. he keeps in the closet at the house that had all the documents and everything that they needed and everything. So
that did take some forethought and some effort. Wow. Mm-hmm. And that's why it happened relatively quickly for you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a problem a lot of refugees have is they might have very legitimate claims for political asylum, but how can they prove them?
Exactly, yeah.
Well, congratulations to your dad for having done that. So they make their way then from Guantanamo to...
So they spent, once they are able to get political asylum, they spend a little bit of time in South Florida, the Homestead area. And they had a couple of options as to where they could stay, whether staying in the Homestead area, going up to Philly or a larger city like New York or Philly. But they ended up nestled in the heart of East Tennessee in Bristol.
Which seems a little incongruous.
Yeah, but it a blessing in disguise because we all had a great upbringing there. But the way that we got there was my sister, who's closest in age to me, her godfather is a missionary within the United Methodist Church, and he had really close ties with First United Methodist in Bristol. And so they sponsored us to get to Bristol, and that's how we... And we're still members at that church, still active participants there. So it's been pretty good.
Well, you say your dad was a judicial official, and your mom was she a traditional housewife, or did she have a job as well outside the home?
So, yeah, mom was just a, not just, but she, her main goal role was really taking care of us and ensuring that we had everything that we needed, which is...
That was back in Haiti, but then when they come here now, what does your dad do?
So dad currently has a degree in computer engineering.
Sounds like a slacker to me. He did that when he got here?
Yeah.
He on top of everything else he was doing, he got a degree in computer engineering.
Yeah, so I can remember being very young and like around preschool and kindergarten and mom being in classes at the local public library to get her GED and learning English as well, because coming here, they didn't know any English.
Well, they didn't know any English at all.
No. So, yeah, they came
Did
here.
Did they speak French? Is that their primary language?
Creole. Yeah.
Creole.
Haitian Creole.
Right. Haitian Creole.
But, yeah, they came here not really knowing anybody, not knowing the language. And so mom and dad both really hustled as much as they possibly could to get us the things that we need eventually. Within a couple of years of being here, purchasing a house, like learning the language, getting gainful employment and everything. I can remember being in preschool at the Montessori, the YMCA, and then mom started working there to like help pay for bills, but also ensure that that she was able to be there with her youngest as I was going through the being socialized and whatnot. And yeah, I just remember both of them working as hard as they possibly could, late nights of staying up, studying English, dad going to community college, and just times where they were both just absolutely exhausted. Mom's told us stories of, like, after getting all five of us into bed, just sitting down on the couch and being so exhausted and just tears flowing down her face from how exhausted she is and just the struggle of raising a family of five and being a support system for five kids and really being in a place where you feel as if you're an outsider because it's there's nobody who really could identify with that specific experience within the community.
Was there no Haitian community at all in Bristol, Virginia or Bristol, Tennessee?
There, a couple of years ago, I can recall a couple families of Haitian descent being in Bristol, but growing up there wasn't really a large Haitian diaspora in East Tennessee. So,
So English is your first language. Do you speak some Creole as well?
I do speak some Creole. I understand it better than I speak it. So like in conversation, like my parents used Creole primarily in the home. So there's definitely a skill that I grew up being able to have. But my Creole's not as strong as I want it to be. If they were to just randomly drop me in the heart of Haiti one day, I'd be able to make my way back and make my way around. But it's not as strong as I would like it to be.
Understood. Mm-hmm. Well, then your own particular path then was to go through, what, the Bristol Public Schools?
Yeah, and then to college. Yeah.
And where'd you go to school? Where'd you go to college?
Yeah, so we all went through the public school system, graduates of Tennessee High, go Vikings. And then, yeah, all of us college educated. My oldest brother went to Asbury up in Lexington. Both my sisters went to Belmont and Nashville. My other brother, the middle child, he is a graduate of ETSU. And then I went to Milligan College in Johnson City as well.
And now you're in law school.
Yeah, now I'm in law school.
Again, sounds like just a family full of slackers. I lost count of the number of college degrees you have there.
We need to get our act together.
Yeah, I guess you really do. Well, you know, that's just quite an impressive story. I mean, these are literally people who have been forced to hide in a cave and then make their way in a raft across the ocean, and yet within just a few years are solidly on their way to a very successful life. That's just a remarkable tale.
Yeah.
Remarkable tale.
Yeah.
What are your plans when you leave the Duncan School of Law?
That is a great question. My plans once I leave the Duncan School. Well, first I need to decide where exactly I'm going to go after I graduate. I think that's.
You stick around here locally in Tennessee, or are you
possibly
thinking of doing something back in Haiti?
I've considered doing some international work, possibly taking the Foreign Service Officer's Test to work with the State Department, but we'll see. I'm a firm believer that God definitely opens up any paths possible. I think me being in law school is evident of that. I think just my family story is evident of that, with all five of us being college educated, with three out of five of us being director level within our careers, my oldest brother having his master's, and then me on my way to get a Juris Doctorate. So the sky's the limit at this point. But we'll see. One of my main passions is being able to invest in the whatever community that I'm in, being able to invest in it and ensure that it's in a better position when I leave than when I arrived. So,
well, I'm sure it will be, Jeff. Very, very, very interesting story. And you continue the tradition of your family's high achievement. I will say that one step at a time.
Yeah.
First, you got to graduate and pass the bar, right?
Exactly.
And then worry about the next step.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well, thanks for sharing your story with us, Jeff.
All right. Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And today we're addressing an important question. Just who are these immigrants anyway? These people we're hearing about in the news so much. These people who are causing so much controversy when they come or attempt to come to our shores. Well, it turns out that several of them are my students. And after the break, we'll talk to one more. Stick around. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with several of my law students today, law students who are either themselves immigrants or who were born here only shortly after their families immigrated, which was the case with my last guest, Jeff Preptee. And now I'm going to speak with one more of my students. Her name is Ruth, and her family is from Peru.
My name is Ruth Arambru, and I'm from Lima, Peru.
Lima, Peru, the capital city.
Yes, sir.
I see. And when were you born, if I may ask?
I was born in 1994.
1994. And how long did you stay in Peru before your family came over?
I lived there till I was 11, and then we moved to the U.S.
What prompted that?
So my mom's sister, who actually I'm named after, she moved to New York about 25-ish years before my family and I moved here, and she just always wanted to live in a different country, wanted to travel the world, so she came here, she loved it, she fell in love, married my uncle, who's Egyptian, so we have a very diverse family.
Very diverse, yeah.
And then once she became a citizen, she started the paperwork for all her family, so naturally, since my mom was... well, is her sister. She started the paperwork for her and her children at the time. So my mom wasn't even pregnant with me at the time.
It took that long.
Yeah.
It took over a decade.
Well, it took a 13 years for my family to get all our papers.
Wow.
So, yeah, but what prompted my parents wanting to start the paperwork to begin with, because it's a lot of time and money that you have to spend, was because there was a lot of terrorism in Peru, especially during the 80s was where it was the worst, and they just wanted to get us out of that, and also they just wanted us to have a better future than was available to us, because in Peru it's very competitive. There's, you have to take a test to get to college, and only I think like 10 or maybe 20% of the people actually pass and get to go to college for free. Other than that, you have to pay, and it's usually really expensive. And my parents had four children, so they weren't going to be able to do that for us.
So you were causing problems for your parents already?
Pretty much.
Okay, I see. Yeah, I've heard it said that having a child is the single worst financial decision a person can make. Well, I think it's probably true. I've told both my boys that.
I hope it's emotionally rewarding.
One hopes. One certainly hopes, because it certainly isn't financially. But at any rate, so it was both economic and political reasons that your parents wanted to come. And they had your aunt Ruth, who was living in New York with her Egyptian husband. And so eventually, at the age of 11, you made it over here. Do you remember much about the journey?
I remember being sad that I was leaving my friends, and I was about to be in sixth grade, you know.
Right.
It was exciting times for
me. Well, you spoke Spanish in Peru.
Yes.
Okay. And so, did you speak any English at all?
I knew very little. So it's kind of like the level of Spanish you were taught here in elementary school is kind of the equivalent of the level of English you're taught in Peru. So I knew like cat, dog, I knew some colors, some numbers, but I didn't really know much. And my oldest brother, he was engaged at the time, so he didn't come with us. He stayed with his now wife. So that was really hard because we, I mean, we've all lived together my whole life and mm-hmm. then just had to part.
My. Yeah. So you came to New York?
We flew into JFK and we stayed there for 4 months. Not 4 months, I'm sorry, 4 days.
Okay. I wish 4 months. Seemed like 4 months, I guess. Okay.
Yeah. but at the time, my Aunt Ruth had already moved to Florida and they had some businesses there. And so we moved to live with them because New York is more expensive and
cold.
Yeah, cold.
Yeah, exactly.
And we're used to being warm, you know, nice and cozy in Peru.
Right.
So we moved to Florida where my aunt was. And then eventually my aunt and uncle decided to move to Tennessee because they had a family friend who lived in Kingsport. And they fell in love with it when they came to visit.
Beautiful area.
Yeah. So they decided to move. And since they were our only family in Florida, we moved with them because we didn't want to just be by ourselves.
It seems like adventurous Aunt Ruth basically leads the family wherever they go. Well, Ruth is the pioneer,
yeah,
and then everybody eventually tags along.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, like, she brought us all to this country, and then
Florida, now Tennessee,
yeah,
okay.
Now Tennessee.
So that's where you grew up then, or at least the latter part of your youth was
yes.
in Kingsport or that area?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
And then you went to college?
Yes, I went to Milligan College in mm-hmm. good old...
Christian College.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Either, I guess, Johnson City or Elizabethton.
Right, it's right in that area.
In the middle.
Mm-hmm. And then decided to come to law school. Well, backing up just a little bit, what are your parents' professions? What do they do?
So in Peru, my father was a police officer, and mm-hmm. he worked for the narcotics department and the investigations department. And my mom worked as a secretary for a school for police officers' children.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we moved, my parents had to adjust to different jobs, and it mm-hmm. was a drastic change for them. My dad was a dishwasher, and my mom was, a fry cook at McDonald's.
Right.
So.
Yeah, that is rough, isn't it? You have a certain level of income, a certain level of professional respect and competence, and then, that's a very common tale, mm-hmm. having to do that. Very difficult. And now you're in law school. Are you the first person in your family to go to law school?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And what brings you to law school?
So growing up, I always thought I wanted to be a teacher because I figured, I want to help people. And then as I got older, I realized lawyers aren't all mean and evil like everyone says.
Oh, come on now. We are. We're nasty, nasty people. All greedy.
But I realized, that's also a great way to get to help people. And then as I got into high school, got my first job, I was working at a restaurant and I met a lot of immigrants. And then I got really interested in immigration and I heard lots of stories, people who came here with papers and once they were close to expiring or they had already expired and they didn't know it. They didn't know who to ask for help. They were afraid that someone was going to turn them into immigration, or they just didn't speak the language, so they didn't even bother. And so that's kind of what led me to just more towards the legal profession rather than teaching. And
so you want to work in immigration law?
I do.
Mm-hmm. Have you done any of that here? Have you had an immigration law course? I think we're offering one this next year.
Yes. I actually took immigration law this past summer with Professor Gill.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been lucky.
Professor Gill volunteers a lot, doesn't he, with an immigration group here, an immigration mm-hmm. rights group.
Yeah. There's Catholic Charities Immigrant mm-hmm. Office of Immigrant Services. I actually did my externship there this summer, and I still go back every week and volunteer with them. They're great. They do a lot of good work. It's only 3 people in the office, but they're awesome at what they do. I mean, they have a really long wait list, and if anyone that's listening is from the area and wants to go help them out and volunteer.
Yeah, I'm sure they can use help of all kinds.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where's that office located?
It's 119 Dameron Avenue
in Knoxville,
Tennessee.
Okay. And so you tell me about that experience. What have you actually done there?
This summer I got to do some research projects, got to help people over the phone, kind of just screening. I got to help with files. I learned a lot just about the process and what all is required, how to talk to people. I was able to sit in on some client interviews.
Do you still speak Spanish?
Yes.
Okay, so I imagine that comes in helpful from time to time.
Yes, so mm-hmm. I help them translate documents, sometimes any birth certificates or personal statements. I was able to help a family actually write their personal statement and just do a lot, and it's really rewarding, and I love it.
As an immigrant yourself, and as someone who is helping immigrants, do you have any thoughts on the current debate that's raging throughout the nation on immigration and all of that stuff?
I have very strong feelings.
Well, share those that you can, if you will, then.
Well, I think, first of all, it's good to clarify that DACA, so Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, isn't a legal status. Like, it's in the name, it's deferred action. Mm-hmm. And
let's back up briefly, because you brought that up. Mm-hmm. First of all, you and your family jumped through all the hoops, and that was to your benefit. Mm-hmm. In fact, are you a citizen now?
No, I'm actually in the process. I applied in April, and I'm still waiting to hear back from Memphis about an interview. So.
Okay. So, I mean, obviously those were decisions that were made when you were a little girl, mm-hmm. so you had no control over them, and I guess that's to your benefit that you don't have any issues in that regard. However, there are lots of children mm-hmm. who, for whatever reason, whose parents didn't go through the steps or don't have the documentation to prove that they did.
Yeah.
And those are a whole group of children who are commonly called dreamers, because they came here very young age and for all intents and purposes grew up in this country and considered themselves Americans, and yet face perhaps deportation because they don't have this status. Now, those are all familiar things. DACA, of course, is a program that was initiated under President Obama that was going to allow some sort of deferred action, some sort of deferral of any negative treatment by the authorities for people in that group, as long as they met certain basic requirements and registered and all of that. That program's now been ended, or is slated to be ended in the very near future. So that's just a little bit of background that probably people already know, but just to clarify. So you're concerned about the Dreamers and the DACA yes. program. Okay, please tell me about that.
So I think a common misconception is that people think that DACA, so Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, is a legal status, and mm-hmm. it's not. It's just deferred action, which just means once you renew it every year, which you have to pay for,
mm-hmm.
Your name gets placed at the bottom of the list. But then you have to renew it, I believe it's every other year that you have to renew it, and it doesn't give them legal status. They're still deportable. Most of them don't even realize that they're not citizens, as you said, because they've grown up here and they didn't know. Like, we've had a lot of people come in the office and their parents are trying to apply for, well, before when this mm-hmm. was still in place, parents were trying to get deferred action for their children, and the kids were really surprised because they legitimately did not realize that they weren't American citizens. And it's just very tough to see that. It's most of them, I mean, they have a country accent. Their Spanish is horrible.
Oh, really?
Like, they're uh-huh. more Tennessean than they are Hispanic. And
so some little kid will come in here with an East Tennessee accent.
Oh, yeah.
Wearing a ball cap and blue jeans, and all of a sudden realizes for the first time that he or she is not a citizen and may not be able to stay here.
Yeah, and I mean, it's rough because if they do get deported, they're going to go back to a country that they don't know, possibly with a language that they don't speak. And it's a different way of living. It's hard to adjust for them. And these are kids who have made a life here, who want to, I mean, they bleed red, white, and blue. Mm-hmm. And they want to succeed in this country and make this country succeed also, because they see it as their country. And
they want to do the same thing you're doing, if I may say so. I mean, you're an example of an immigrant who is getting an education, gaining a profession, mm-hmm. and is on the verge of going out there and being, well, already, you're already making contributions through your volunteer work in society, and yet a person who's not, doesn't have a solid immigration status would have great difficulty getting student loans, mm-hmm. or even going to a lot of colleges.
Yeah, so that's also a problem. Like, they don't have financial aid available. They don't have all the sources that other people do. And I think I was watching something on, I think it was a documentary. I forget where it was, but it was, they interviewed someone, and the person legitimately believed that illegal immigrants got free, or undocumented immigrants, excuse me, got free healthcare and free laptops. So that's also a misconception, because first of all, I mean, I'd like to see where they're getting all these laptops.
Yeah, I'd like to get get me a free laptop.
People who are undocumented don't get any kind of benefits because they don't have the paperwork to be legally in this country. And a lot of people just check it off as, oh, you know, like, they're just here because they want all their benefits. But really, they're here, and a lot of them, if they don't have ITINs, which are, it's like a social security number, but it's only for tax filing purposes,
mm-hmm.
They're still contributing somehow to our taxes and our economy. And so they're not getting any benefits, but they're still contributing, and a lot of people don't realize that. So,
why? Do you have any friends who have had that experience of suddenly finding out that their status here is shaky? I mean, someone who's like you, except didn't have parents that went through the process?
I do not. I have a friend whose parents applied for political asylum when she was 4. And, I mean, it's rough because they have to go back every year, and I think the U.S. never actually granted them asylum. So they're here only temporarily. So at any point in time, the U.S. can decide that they're not going to keep them here anymore, and they're just going to have to figure out where to go. And, I mean, I would hate to be in that situation, just of uncertainty as to where I'm going to be living. Like, I could be here today, but then who knows about tomorrow. And
mm-hmm. Well, Ruth, thank you very much for sharing your experiences and your perspectives with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely, and I wish you the best of luck in your legal career.
Thank you.
Thanks so much to all of my guests today, Akram Pfizer, Leila Hadzik, Jeff Preptee, and Ruth Arambrew. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our production intern is Donald Crenshaw. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment, even if you just arrived here recently.